It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore the story of one of the most decorated distance runners in U.S. history, two-time Olympian marathoner Kara Goucher. Her new memoir traces her evolution as a world-class runner with family roots in Duluth and becoming a whistleblower in Nike's prestigious Oregon Project. Kara exposes a running team at Nike's headquarters with an abusive, toxic culture that disbanded in 2019. And please be aware, be thoughtful that this conversation deals with sexual assault. Take care. Call in with questions about running and athletes pushed to extremes, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kara Goucher's new memoir is called The Longest Race, Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's Elite Running Team. Kara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start in a place that you hold near and dear to your heart. And this is a place, you're in the company of people who love Lake Superior and Duluth. How did your upbringing in Minnesota influence the start of your career?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so proud to be from Minnesota. But I started running. My first race I ever did was when I was 6 years old. My grandpa actually took me to my first race. And then I would just do little races in Duluth, throughout the year, here and there. And really, I didn't start really running organized until I was in middle school.
Your grandfather, Papa, had really influenced how you approached running. And I was just wondering, you know, he had that recipe for mastery. How did he influence your running?
You know, he took a huge interest in it, but one of the things that I was so lucky was that he was a lifelong runner, but he wasn't a racer. He just enjoyed the movement of running and the process of moving through space, and I really got that from him. I loved running before I realized I was good at it, before I realized it could take me anywhere, and I just learned from him that there's so much more than just racing with running. It really can be this big part of your life that you love and that helps you. You know, for him, it was like meditation. And I feel like I got that from him.
And there's an art to running that you hold so dear to you because it can't be taken away from you. Something I learned in your book, that you really hold it as sacred.
Yeah, it really is like I am religious, but it is like a religious practice to me. It's my meditation. You know, obviously, I became a very competitive athlete. I went to 2 Olympic Games. But I still, like, it's still a huge part of my day today. Like, when I'm done talking to you, I'm going to go run. So it's just a huge part of who I am and how I feel centered and how I navigate the world and deal with stress and things like that. Running helps me get through all of that.
I wonder what it's like to run, you know, after we have a conversation. Do you still have goals in mind? Do you still feel like you need to push yourself? Or do you go just to run just for the feel of it?
I mostly run for the feel of it now, although every once, you know, once a week or so, I'll try to do something a little bit harder. So maybe I'll try to do some hill repeats while I'm out. I still like the feeling of pushing myself, but it's not, you know, before there was like a goal in mind and I would have to push myself to reach that goal or to get better. And I no longer worry about that. I just like to get out and be in space.
Do you like to run alone or with a partner?
I like both. I like running alone a lot because I feel like I work out a lot of my problems and things about life. And it really is almost like a meditation to me. But then I do like to meet up with friends and just, you know, run for an hour and it goes by so quick because we're all chatting. I do miss that part about being a competitive athlete, about having teammates and meeting up with people on a regular basis and working towards goals together. But I also enjoy the solitude more and more as I get older of just running by myself.
Kara Goucher with us. New memoir is called The Longest Race. Author, 2-time Olympic marathoner. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Kara, you had that realization, even as an 8th grader, that you said everyone expected you to win. How has that pressure affected? You know, how did that affect you even at such a young age on, you know, the Duluth Middle School cross country team?
Yeah, I definitely felt anxiety at an early age related to performance in sport. And so that was something, you know, one of one of the not so great things of being a good athlete was that I felt the expectation that I would win every race or I would get faster every track season, every time I stepped on the track. And that was something that was always kind of hard for me. And as I became older, you know, I started working with sports psychologists, but when I was younger, I definitely felt this pressure that everyone expects me to win and everyone expects me to run fast. And, you know, it just was unrealistic. Like, you can't always be on the top of your game every single day and your body goes through changes. But very early on, I felt that pressure.
It was interesting, too, when you ask your younger sister to pass you in a race, you hear her behind you and you give her almost like this permission. And I wondered even aloud whether that is something unique to girls or even women. I wonder, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you know, I was late going through puberty. I didn't start my period until halfway through my junior year of high school. So my senior year, I was still adjusting to this new body. I grew about 8 inches and put on a significant amount of weight. And during that time, it was about 2 to 3 years where I really struggled with this new body. It just felt clumsy and bigger. And I think it is unique to girls because before that, I was the little one beating all the older girls, right? But then my body started to change and I went through this period of adapting to it. And yes, when I was a senior, my little sister was just running right behind me, just holding back because she didn't want to upset me by passing me. And I told her to go ahead and pass me. And it was a humbling experience. And it reminded me of the kindness that I had seen from other girls in the past because I had had to run past people that I looked up to and respected when I had been younger.
And, you know, just encouraging girls not to hold back. I think that too is such, you know, is so relevant. What should young people today know about the power dynamic that exists between these young athletes and their coaches?
Yeah, I think there is this really big power dynamic in high school and college and beyond. And it's just about, like, you know, boundaries, what your coach should and should not be talking to you about. You know, there's so many amazing coaches out there. I had amazing high school and collegiate experience with great coaches. But they shouldn't be your live or die. Like, their word shouldn't be more important than your parents, than your friends. Like, they're there to guide you and help you be as successful as you can be, but they shouldn't have control over you and your life. And, you know, I found myself in a situation as a professional where I did feel that way. And so I just want people to know that coaches are there to help you achieve your dreams and to help you be the best you can be, but they shouldn't be controlling you.
And it's when you're in that situation where you become close with the coach and they're there and instructing you, you're following, you know, everything they say, it's hard not to cross that line of understanding what are the limits.
Yeah, and I think it's especially hard for girls. I think we're kind of raised to be pleasers and polite and, you know, make people proud. And, you know, I would say that I was like a good girl. You know, you tell me to do something, I'm going to do it. And so I do think it's a little harder for girls because we kind of grow up being told, like, don't disrupt, do what you're asked. And so many of us are pleasers, especially I feel like runners specifically are very much wired to please and to push. And so it can be really hard. And that's why having open conversation with teammates, with parents, with other people around you is important to make sure that you're having that healthy relationship with your coach.
Two-time Olympian Kara Goucher with us, one of the most decorated female American runners ever. A new memoir called The Longest Race. Colin, with questions, your comments about running, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with two-time Olympian Kara Goucher, first woman to join the Oregon Project, that elite and secretive running team that was powered by Nike, and a disgraced coach banned from the sport for sexual misconduct. Nike shuttered the project in 2019. Kara Goucher has a new memoir called The Longest Race. Call in with your questions and your comments, 800-642-1234. And please be mindful that this conversation is sensitive and it involves sexual assault. Take care, please. Kara, I want to get into the Oregon Project. And like I thought that it was so interesting. You found it to be an invitation to a special forces unit or Hogwarts. What was it like?
You know, it was really groundbreaking at the time. There was little groups of people training together across the United States, but there wasn't a group that was professionalized in that sense, where they had a full team. You know, that they had a team of doctors, people who would do body work on you, access to equipment, like the best equipment in the world. We would be training on the Nike campus and have access to all of the things there, testing, lab testing. I mean, it's just, it was a different way of looking at running, professionalizing it in a way, and treating it as this long-term goal. And I mean, my husband and I went to visit, and we were blown away. We had never seen anything like it. And we knew if we went there and we couldn't make it, that we just weren't meant to be. Everything that we needed to be successful would be at our fingertips.
Your coach, Alberto Salazar, picks you up from the airport. What was it like, your initial impressions?
You know, he was so nice. And honestly, and I think he would admit this, they wanted Adam on the team. There were no women on the team. And Adam had been...
Your husband.
My husband. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, my husband, Adam. He had kind of been like the great hope for American distance running. And he had struggled for a few years. And Alberto and Nike really believed they could bring him back to glory. And so I was kind of just an add-on. But I will say, like, Alberto picked us up from the airport. He was very kind. We expected someone else to pick us up, but he was the one that met us there. And, you know, on the drive to the hotel, he did dive into this story about Mary Decker Slaney, who had received a ban for testosterone levels. And we didn't even know, but he had been working with her at the time. And he explained all of it to us and explained that the test they use with her, they don't use it anymore. And it was this horrible incident. And, you know, Adam and I got to the hotel and thought, wow, that's so amazing that he brought that up to us, because at some point we would have heard about it and we would have asked it, and it could have been very uncomfortable. And then he showed us around for a couple of days, and we were really taken in by him. He's very charismatic. He was like very determined that he was going to bring Adam back. And it just seemed like, why would we say no? I mean, he literally said, give me 6 months. I will pay for everything. If you don't like it, you can go back home. And so for us, it was a no-brainer to give it a shot.
He had this high-volume coaching style. What was a typical week like for you in running mileage and what you were doing as far as training?
Yeah, well, when I first got there, I actually got injured pretty quickly and had to have surgery. But by the couple years in, you know, it was a lot. We met in the mornings. We would do a very hard training session. We would go to the gym together, work out in the gym. We'd have lunch, take a nap. Then we'd get up. We would do drills, do other types of exercises like strength exercises, body weight exercises. Then we'd go for another run. Then we'd eat and go to bed. And I mean, there were times where I was running. I mean, as I got older and as I moved from the track to the marathon, you know, I was running over 120 miles a week and doing all sorts of drills and weightlifting and things like that. So it was definitely full time. There was no time for anything else. Any time that you had was time to rest and get ready for the next session.
And these training tools that you were supposed to use, like the altitude tent, can you explain like how this training took over your life and what the altitude tent was?
So Portland is obviously not up at elevation, but being up at elevation kind of shocks your body into producing more red blood cells. And that's a benefit. You can run longer and harder. And so there were times where we'd go to training camp and be up at altitude. But when we were in Portland, we would sleep in these altitude tents, which was literally just like a clear plastic tent over your bed. And there would be a machine pumping in less oxygenated air. So the thought was, you know, the best thing they say for distance athletes is to live high and train low, live high at elevation, but train low at sea level, which is nearly impossible across the world to have a situation like that. So this was a way to do that while being in Portland. We would sleep in these tents. Eventually we had our house sealed, parts of our house sealed, so we could just hang out and watch TV and have dinner at altitude. And then, we would get up and go outside and be at sea level to train.
How hot was it inside these plastic tents?
Well, it was so bad. I mean, like, sweat would just be dripping down our faces, and it was so uncomfortable. And my husband would always, like, string up a fan and hang it from the top of the tent, and I would always be like, please don't let that fall. But it felt so good. It would be very, very hot. And again, like, my husband was an elite athlete, and so we had two people in the tent, which it makes them even hotter. And it's funny looking back because it was so uncomfortable, but you just get used to all these things. You get used to it. You're doing it because you have this big goal that you want to achieve, and it's just part of the training.
Alberto instructed runners to weigh in before races. What do you make of those orders now?
Looking back, there were so many red flags along the way. You know, at the time, I just kind of told myself, well, he just wants to know where our weight is, and, you know, men aren't bothered by it as much as women, and I'm the only woman here. You know, looking back, it was a way to control. And for me, it did sort of spiral me a little bit. I definitely had some issues with food and being good to my body in college. And it kind of brought some of that back, that fear that I would step on the scale and see a number that was too heavy or that Alberto wouldn't like. And so, you know, I started tracking calories and things like that and tracking my weight so that I wouldn't be caught off guard if he weighed me. I would know, like, what the scale was going to say, and I wouldn't be caught off guard.
When he didn't like the number that he saw on the scale, what would he do?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
When he didn't like how much you weighed, when you weighed in, what was his shaming like?
I mean, he would just tell you. I mean, I was lucky where I mostly was always at a weight that he was happy with. But I did have a teammate later on when I had been there, and he would just flat out say, you're fat. I mean, he would say, you are fat. Mm-hmm. And you are not going to run well. You know, for me, he would say, you're just too heavy, like, you're not going to run well. You know, it would just be so harsh, like, all the work you had done, all the training you had done, even if your training had been going great, if you stepped on the scale and it was a heavier number than he wanted to see, he would just dismiss all the hard work and the fitness you had because you were just too fat.
Talking with Kara Goucher, two-time Olympian marathoner, looking at the work distance runners put in, her new memoir, What It Exposes. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let us dive in on doping. You explore how fellow runners took performance-enhancing drugs. Did you ever consider taking performance-enhancing drugs to become a better runner?
Oh, absolutely not. And my husband is very adamant. You know, he was always like, I'm going to find out what I can be. And if when I find the limit, then it's done. And I felt the same way. I feel like a lot of that is how I was raised. I knew I wasn't the best athlete in the world. You know, I knew that. But I wanted to see how far I could take it with what I had. And I wanted to see if an opportunity opened up in a race, if I could pounce and get a medal or make a podium. And, you know, I think I was grounded in that sense, especially from my upbringing of, like, you just do the best you can do, and that's what it is. Like, you can't do more than your best. And so I was always, you know, I wanted to win. I wanted to do really well. But as long as I did my best, that was going to be enough for me. And that was my goal. My goal was to take my career as far as I could take it and find out how far I could take it and then move on when I got to that point.
You and Adam are diagnosed with hypothyroidism, which becomes like a common diagnosis there on the team taking this hormone medication, Loboxil. What did that tell you about, you know, what this team was trying to do?
You know, again, it's the looking back, the hindsight. But, you know, at the time, Adam and I were diagnosed right before we went to the Oregon Project. And when we got there, obviously we told Alberto and the team, like, the doctors that we saw, medications that we were on, which was just that. And then Alberto went to see Dr. Brown, Dr. Jeffrey Brown in Houston, and he was also diagnosed with it. But then it was like everyone on the team went down to Houston and came back with the same diagnosis. And, you know, it's frustrating looking back, but we just thought, well, that, what a weird coincidence. You know, like, it's not very common, and yet everyone seems to have it on the team. But it's as we understood it, it wasn't like plain old Loboxil wasn't a performance enhancer in any way. And so we just kind of thought, wow, that's strange. That's strange that all these great world-class athletes have this issue. Of course, looking back, it's very obvious that someone was trying to manipulate the system.
We have a decorated American long-distance runner, two-time Olympian Kara Goucher's new memoir. It is called The Longest Race. Call in with your questions, your comments about running, extreme distances, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A former runner for Nike and two-time Olympian Kara Goucher shares her story at this moment of reckoning for some elite women runners who reveal what it's like in a sport contending with eating disorders, physical and emotional abuse, doping allegations. Kara became a whistleblower. Her new book is called The Longest Race. And please take care in this sensitive conversation. Be mindful. The number to call, 800-642-1234 to join in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kara, going back to 2015, you and your husband publicly accuse the Nike coach, Alberto Salazar, of violating anti-doping rules. The FBI comes to your home. You become a whistleblower. So Salazar initially receives a 4-year ban from coaching over doping, later receives a lifetime ban for sexual misconduct. Do you think that these punishments go far enough?
Yeah, it's tough, right? It's a difficult situation, but I believe that he should have had a lifetime ban for the anti-doping violations. I feel like it should just, you know, if you found him guilty of 4 violations, then it should just be a lifetime ban, in my opinion. The safe sport ruling was a lifetime ban, although it's only at the Olympic level. So technically, this fall, when his doping ban runs out, he could coach at the high school or collegiate level. And so I don't think it's enough, because I just think he shouldn't be allowed to coach, period, across any type of at any level. But at least he won't be able to have the control he had at the elite level anymore.
When you say Safe Sport, what does this organization do?
Safe Sport was formed, in the wake of the Nassar scandal and all these things, to be a place where athletes could go to report emotional, physical, sexual abuse. And it's the problem with Safe Sport is there's, unfortunately, so many cases, and it really gets backlogged. But in my situation, there was 2 other women that were filing with Safe Sport or wanted an investigation into Alberto, and I had been avoiding Safe Sport for almost 2 years, but I finally agreed to be a part of the investigation. And they investigate all the claims. I think the first investigation took about 1.5 years, and he was banned for life. Then he appealed that, as he should be able to. And then we went to basically an arbitration, but it was sort of like a civil court trial where he had witnesses and, we gave testimony and had evidence and things like that. And the ban was upheld at that point. So Safe Sport is there to protect athletes, but it's limited. It's limited in what it can do.
Can you explain a bit what happened to you in these post-workout massages that led to your talking eventually with Safe Sport about what happened to you?
Yeah, as we were talking about earlier in the conversation, like, lines get blurred sometimes with coaches and their power and just how much control they have over your life. But I had been getting these flushes from Alberto I got them the entire time I was there, where he would just sort of tuck your shorts up and kind of expose your butt, and he would just give you a massage. But there were 2 incidences when we were alone and we had traveled to a foreign country together, just the 2 of us, where I was getting one of these, what we would call a quick flush. And as I was lying there, his hand just got higher and higher until I felt like his fingers were going where they shouldn't go. And it was very uncomfortable. I didn't say anything. I didn't jump off the bed. I actually was completely frozen both times and tried to convince myself that it had to have been a mistake.
This happens in Italy. It happens in Portugal. You are so far from home and your support systems when you're on the road like that. Was that difficult to just carry on, or did you just try to put it out of your mind? What did you do?
You know, there was a little bit of freaking out when he left the hotel room, but you know, athletes are really good at compartmentalizing. I think you have to be able to put aside any pain you're feeling. You have to be able to put aside any emotions. You have to really be present in the moment and put aside anything that could distract you from that. And I think I'm just really good at that in general. My father died when I was little. I put that in a box, put it aside. It's not going to affect me. And so that's basically what I did. I had a few moments of, did that just happen? How did that just happen? And then it was sort of like I convinced myself, nope, it had to have been a mistake. And because the alternative was too much. The alternative was I'm alone in a foreign country with him. I have no one to talk to. If I wait and get home and talk to someone, my dreams are over. He coaches me, but we are funded by Nike, who's also my sponsor, who provides for my family. And so if I say anything, I'm going to lose everything. Not only am I going to lose you know, all the hard work I put in, like I'm going to lose my job. And so for me, it was just, I couldn't even let my mind go down that track. I had to just shut it off and put it in a box and pretend like, you know, he's not a licensed massage therapist. And it was a mistake.
You called him the gatekeeper to your dreams. I mean, there was such power, such control. How were you able to even realize what that power was like in that time, in that period?
You know, I just, anytime anything made me uncomfortable, I just think I'm so close to achieving the things I want to achieve. No situation is perfect. I mean, these are the dreams I've had since I was a child, and they're right there. Like, I've given up everything to be here and to be in this moment. I can't rock the boat or lose it now. And I think that's the hard part, especially as an athlete, where you work so hard for this dream you've had, like, literally for decades, and you don't want to do anything that would jeopardize that. And so, you know, of course, looking back and working through it in therapy, I realized how manipulated I was, how trapped I was. But at the time, again, I would just convince myself, hey, and I was reminded by the staff there that I'm lucky to be here. Anyone would trade places with me. I'm so close to achieving everything I've ever wanted to achieve. Like, I just have to, you know, anything that's uncomfortable, just push it aside because it's worth it, because you've worked so hard to be here.
Did anyone at Nike reach out to you or hear you or want to help in any way? Were there any allies within Nike at large?
No. I knew everybody up the chain, all the way up to the president, and they were all male. They were all men. Our support staff, our trainers were men. The people who did body work on us were men. The person that I believed was a sports psychologist, but turned out to not be a sports psychologist, was a man. And then up the chain at Nike, the head of sports marketing who wrote our contract was a man, John Capriati. And then, of course, at one point I did go to Mark Parker with pregnancy issues, but he was also a man. And everybody would, you know, I felt like there was nowhere safe to go where I could be just trusted or be heard out without consequences. I think that's part of the problem, is that everything was tied to the brand. And at the end of the day, I knew they would choose protecting the brand over any concerns that I had. I was disposable. I was very easily disposable. But of course, Nike as a brand is not.
I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk with one of the most decorated distance runners in U.S. history, two-time Olympian marathoner Kara Goucher. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kara, let's turn to your pregnancy and really shocking and amazing, your experience during pregnancy and how you carried on. What should people know about this time of your life when you carried your baby and you were running at the same time?
Yeah, I think, you know, the followers and the interest in me really rose during my pregnancy. I had asked my coach, Alberto Salazar, what would happen when I would get pregnant. We actually planned when I would get pregnant together. Like, he was a part of those conversations with my husband and I. And it was an open conversation. I really wanted to be a mom. I did not want to wait until my career was over. So we had these conversations of what timing would be right. And before I got pregnant, Alberto went and talked to the sports marketing director, John Capriati, about what would happen to my contract. And he said, whoa, as long as she stays relevant, there'll be no issue. And so Nike actually orchestrated my pregnancy announcement. They had an article that they orchestrated on the front page of the sports section of the New York Times on Mother's Day, which announced my pregnancy. I did about 20 appearances during that time. And like, I was getting more and more, I don't want to use the word famous, but more people were learning of me more in the running industry. In fact, I was told at that time that someone in sports marketing said I was the most requested athlete by media, a female athlete at Nike at the time across all sports. So you can imagine my surprise when my cut was just suspended without a deadline on it. About 3 months before I gave birth to my son, they just stopped paying me. And when I inquired why, they said it was because of my medical condition. So I think that was very, very difficult for me. They were selling one image of supporting women through all aspects of their life. But the truth is, I wasn't being paid, and I was running and eventually racing without getting paid.
Yes. Go deeper into those contracts. I mean, Nike called your pregnancy a medical condition. You use the word relevant. Nike withholding your contract pay due to pregnancy. What can you tell us about these contracts and what you were bound to?
So the contracts have racing requirements. They have appearance requirements, racing requirements, and then they have performance requirements. And so that's why I wanted to know ahead of time what is going to happen to my contract, because obviously I'm not going to be able to race for at least a year. Essentially when they withheld payment, they said that I had too much time lapsed between competitions because I had run the world championships and then I had gone through fertility treatment. And so it had been over 120 days, which you have to race within 120 days. But I was baffled because I was on the cover of magazines. I was in multiple magazines. I was doing appearances, and everyone was embracing this journey and the story they were telling about you can have it all. You can be an elite athlete, Olympic athlete, and have a family. I basically was told you're not upholding your end of the contract, so we won't be paying you. And it was very frustrating because had I known that, I still would have had a baby. I really wanted to be a mom, but I wouldn't have done all these appearances. I wouldn't have flown all over the United States during that time. So I took time to myself and enjoyed my pregnancy. So then there was a clock that had started. I mean, they were flat out told, the sooner you return to competition, the sooner you'll start getting paid again. And so it led me down this path of really rushing to come back from my pregnancy, racing when my son was only 3 months old, racing the Boston Marathon before he was even 7 months old, to try to stop this clock and get back out there so that I could return to being paid.
Mm. And there was even time where you were paying like back pay of the pay. You know, I mean, that it was just crazy, like paying back the pay that they were taking away from you. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, at one point they offered, because they didn't know how long the suspension would be. I kept saying, is it 6 months? Is it a year? They said, well, it might be 18 months. It might be 12 months. This is all going on while I'm nursing a baby, training 120 miles a week, and going out and racing. Ugh. And at one point they offered to give me an advance on pay until we settled out how long I would be suspended without, or how long my suspension would be. And so they advanced me 2 payments, and then later on I had to pay those back. So I had to go 2 quarters without being paid later on.
It was just so abundantly clear that your decision to have a baby was not to get in the way of what your athletic pursuits were, what Nike wanted for you. That that was very clear, that message.
Yeah, it was really hard for me because I believed that I was in this Nike family. I believed that I would be there for my entire life. I believed when I was done racing, I would help coach or help work at Nike in some capacity. And, you know, even my coach, like, didn't come see my son he didn't visit me in the hospital. He didn't come to see my son. It just was really hard. I felt I had believed that I was an important member of this family, that I was supported to have this child. And they were certainly, Nike was certainly telling the story of my comeback and what it's like and throughout the pregnancy. So it was just very devastating. I felt really betrayed, if I'm being honest. I felt like, wow, I was told that I matter, that I'm super important, that yes, of course you can have a child. And here I am now being punished for it.
Kara Goucher details the inside story of the Oregon Project. The elite running team funded by Nike shuttered in 2019, the coach receiving a lifetime suspension from the sport for sexual misconduct. Be part of the conversation at any point. Call in with questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nike was behind the Oregon Project, this elite group of American runners whose first female was Kara Goucher. Her new memoir describes how the coach fostered a culture of misogyny and abuse. Kara was a whistleblower. Join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara, we heard from Adam in Deerfield, called in to say Adam is really sorry you went through this experience and wants to know if there were other options from Nike and how this has affected racing.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. You know, I eventually was able to get out of my contract and leave Nike, and I went to a women's led company called Wazelle and had a different shoe sponsors for Skechers and now with Ultra. It affected my ability to get into races, if I'm being honest, once I left Nike. Nike is the biggest supporter of track and field in the United States and really across the world. They fund a lot of the races and marathons and track meets and things like that. So I found it more difficult to get into races. There were races where I was flat out told I was not welcome. So by leaving Nike, you know, it made my soul feel better, but it made my job of being a professional athlete harder.
Is Nike kind of a gatekeeper to these races? Like, how much influence do they have over what athlete races?
They have incredible influence. I mean, Nike is the biggest funder of our governing body, United States Track and Field, and that's a problem, in my opinion, that a sponsor, a shoe sponsor, can really be the biggest funder of our governing body. There's a lot of conflict of interest. And so we see this in races. We see this in groups that get funding. We see it in athletes that are marketed by our governing body. It's just a conflict of interest. And, you know, especially when you get to these major marathons, when they have a big title sponsor, they get to sort of help weave out the elite field. And even in track and field, pay attention to the Prefontaine Classic in September. Although it'll be different this year because that's the Diamond League final. But typically you see mostly Nike athletes. And we saw it indoors. There was a track meet called Miller's Games, and it was mostly Nike athletes. And so that's the problem. Like, if you're a Nike athlete, you might get an opportunity that another athlete wouldn't get, even though you have the exact same resume. And that, for me, is frustrating and hard to see. I don't have a problem with Nike supporting track and field. I think that's great. But I think when it comes to the cost of someone sponsored by someone else having an equal opportunity, that's a problem.
Let's go to Kathy in Appleton, a former collegiate athlete. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, thank you so much for this show. I just caught it at the end here, but longtime listener, first-time caller, Kara, you caused me to call in. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story. It's such an important story, even in the 21st century, that women are still experiencing this. And as a former collegiate athlete, certainly not to your level, back in the 80s and early 90s, you know, the world was a lot different, but it just behooves me or shocks me to hear that today you're experiencing this. And wow, the power of a female, that you carried your baby and were continuing to train. I just want to give you a cool shout out, and I'm a huge fan of yours. So thank you so much.
Kathy, thank you for the call. Kara, what do you want people to take away from this?
You know, I think we need to really, I appreciate that call, by the way. I appreciate that so much. I think we need to reexamine the power dynamics. What I would love to see is a third party checking in on athletes that's not associated with a governing body, that's not associated with a sponsor, almost like we do how we do drug testing, where people come in and you have to be open to drug testing or you can't compete, but this would be a totally independent party. But I want people to be aware of the dynamics. I do think the education needs to start younger in high school, learning what's appropriate for a coach to be talking to you about and what's not. But I think one of my biggest messages I want people to know is that I'm happy. I don't see myself as someone who is damaged by being sexually assaulted. I see myself as like a very fulfilled human. And while it was a really hard time in my life and hard to get over, I feel like I have moved on from it. Mm-hmm. I think there's so many women that have experienced things like I experienced, and I just want them to know it does not have to define you. It's something that happened to you, but you didn't do anything wrong, and it does not have to define you. And you can move forward, and you can live the life that you want to live.
Let's bring in Allison and Racine. Allison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I first wanted to commend and thank your guest for all the work she's done and shining light on these really important issues and very personal issues for her, but that can help other people. So thank you for that work. But I wanted to say that I think going back to the pressure she felt with having had a child and the discrimination she experienced by having a child, it's just incredible that in this country, women do not have federally protected paid maternity leave. Mm. It's really terrible that it's like having an illness. You have to take sick leave if you want to have paid leave.
Allison, so thank you. We're short on time, and I want Kara to be able to respond. Kara, go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate that call, and it is frustrating. I feel like, you know, I was shocked that I wasn't able to use the daycare at Nike. I would go to race, and I would have to ask for an extra plane ticket so that my mom could come and take care of my son. And I would get a lot of, well, can't you just leave him at home? And I'd say, no, I'm nursing him. And I hope that we've pushed for change. There have been contract amendments over the last few years. There are more women getting pregnant in track and field and being protected, but I completely agree that it is treated like an illness, and that's too bad. You know, mm-hmm. as an athlete, had I been supported and had I been able to come back a little bit slower, I probably wouldn't have faced the injuries that I did, which I repeatedly faced. Hip injuries and femur injuries for the rest of my career. And I do believe it was because, you know, I was back running 100 miles a week before my son was even 2 months old. And that was a mistake.
Kara, thank you for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kara Goucher, author of The Longest Race, Inside the Secret World of Abuse, Doping, and Deception on Nike's Elite Running Team. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.